Dr. Rona Novick. Dr. Novick is the director of the Fania Gottesfeld Heller Doctoral Program at the Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration at Yeshiva University, an associate clinical professor of child psychology at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and a co-educational director of Hidden Sparks. Dr. Novick received her PhD from Rutgers University and interned at Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. She developed the Alliance for School Mental Health at North Shore Long Island Jewish Medical Center and served as its director, authoring the Brave Bully Prevention Program. She is recognized for her expertise in child behavior therapy and has published scholarly articles on school applications of behavior management, children and trauma, and bully prevention. She's a licensed clinical psychologist with a specialization in child anxiety disorders, cognitive behavior therapy, and family therapy. She is the author of a book for parents, Helping Your Child Make Friends, and editor of the book series, Kids Don't Come with Instruction Manuals. I'm also delighted tonight to introduce our technical facilitator, Betsy Kane, who will be working with Rona. Welcome, Rona and Betsy. And now, Rona, please take it away.
Thanks so much, Judith. You know, our session tonight is titled, Is This Typical? I think actually after the colon, instead of understanding variations in child development, it could be understanding variations in weather. I hope you're all nice and warm and toasty wherever you are. We're still shuffling out a little bit from our snow here. And what I hope we'll do today is to look at the fact that some of our students seem to achieve milestones while others struggle, and how we can make the very difficult judgment of whether what we're seeing with our students is typical or whether it's something that should cause us or children or parents concern. To do that, we're going to talk about child development along a continuum, and we're going to focus tonight on preschool through elementary school students, those of you who teach at the other end of the spectrum as well. Next week, we're going to meet again and focus on middle and high school students. If we could have the next slide. What I hope we'll all leave tonight is with a clearer understanding of the developmental progression, and in particular, becoming familiar with temperament and how it plays a role in development and in our classrooms. And I also hope that we will leave tonight, I'm sorry to say, without any easy answers, but recognizing the complexity of the is this typical question. And that being said, if we could have the next slide, I'd like all of us to start by thinking about our own atypicality or typicality and think of your own behavior, your development, an area of learning, something, a time in your life where people were asking about you, or perhaps you were asking about yourself, is this typical? Is Rona going to be this little all of her life? Those of you, the advantage to webinars is you don't see me, but on a good day, I'm 5 feet tall. So is this a typical progression? Will she grow, et cetera? And how did it resolve, or is it still an area of concern? And anyone who would care to share something they've thought of, please do, either in the chat room or on the phone. In the meantime, can we go to the next slide? Anybody who wants to share something about a time in their own development when they wondered or someone wondered about them whether something was typical?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I sometimes used to wonder whether I was very slow on the uptake for things and whether this was typical of development, where, you know, I would have trouble, even sometimes now, have trouble understanding something, you know.
Okay.
Do I have some kind of an issue here?
Thank you for sharing that. Anyone else?
Hi, this is Susan.
Hi, Susan.
Yeah, when I was young, when I was in the primary grades and my mother used to go up to school for parent conferences, they used to say that I was very, very shy, didn't want to talk. When I got into junior high school, I remember she went up to conferences and the teacher said I was talking too much. I don't know what happened, but obviously I opened up or I felt more confident. I don't know.
I was just going to say that given that we've got dozens of people on the call and you piped right in there, obviously there's been some resolution of the question of were you too shy. Thanks, Susan. Anyone else? Well, keep that in the back of your mind. Think about yourself as we begin by thinking about a youngster who I have called David. He is an actual student. I've just disguised some of the facts to protect his identity. And imagine that when you enter his class, David is at work. He's a handsome, neatly dressed student who looks very carefully at the work he's doing in front of him. He does rock his chair and is reminded periodically to keep his chair still. Other students seem to have finished the same assignment that he's working on. He looks over at a neighbor's workspace and grabs a marker and receives in return a loud protest from his neighbor. At that point, David walks to the corner of the room and turns his back, facing his face and body into the corner, and begins talking to himself. Do you think this is typical? And what would you need to know to answer the question?
Well, it doesn't seem typical to me. And I think you need to know whether he does this all the time. But I don't know. It just doesn't seem like typical behavior.
Excellent. So one, you're beginning to wonder, is this typical? And one question you're asking yourself is about frequency. Is this a once-in-a-blue-moon thing? We've never seen anything like this before. Or is this something David does 25 times a day? Are there other people who have an opinion about whether it's typical or not, or have a different question they would want the answer to? And feel free to use phone or chat room.
This is Lisa. I'm just looking at your comment here that David walks to the corner of the room and turns his back facing the corner. Was he asked to do that, or he actually just got up and walked?
No, he was not asked. It was in response to his neighbor being angry with him that David grabbed his marker.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that was in hiding, or does that look like that was a behavior to, like, punish himself type thing, I guess?
So another great question that you're saying, I want to know more about this behavior. Even the behavior itself that's been described, I want to know, I've left out of this discussion, what's David's mood seem like? What's his facial expression? Does he walk calmly to the corner, or is he storming off to the corner? Is he sobbing there? There are a lot of pieces about the behavior itself that's missing. Interesting to me, no one yet, let me ask before I say, any other questions people would ask?
Well, it's also strange that he's speaking to himself.
Hello?
Yes?
This is Hannah. I would like to know his health condition also.
His what? I didn't hear?
I'm saying that I would like to know as a teacher his health condition. It can be emotionally too. More information about background about him.
Okay.
Hello?
Yes. And someone else wanted to add something?
I would like to know how the other kids respond to him.
Wonderful. And interestingly, Amy in the chat room, Amy Friedman, thank you, you asked the question that I thought was the most telling question, which is, how old is David? Does it make a difference to you? Is this typical behavior? And how would you answer the question if I told you this was a 2-year-old class? Or if I told you that this was a 10-year-old boy, how would that alter the question of is this typical? And that factor, that age is really so critical, is exactly what we're going to be confronting and talking about today as we talk more about development. Can we have the next slide? Any last comment? We're going to come back to David in a bit, but any other comments about things that you would want to know about him?
Well, his family situation.
Okay. So clearly, we're also saying that knowing whether a particular snippet of behavior is typical or not in a child's presentation requires an investigation of a lot more than just what happened in that moment. Now, what do we know about the process of development? I've given you three possibilities here. Graph A, B, or C. And I'd like to see a vote. Use your hand-raising signal right above the chat room. There's a hand-raising. And so if you think that the best picture of how development happens for a child, a normal developing, typically developing child, is A, then please raise your hand now. Now, Judith, I apologize. I forgot. There's another way to vote. What was B going to do?
B could do the check.
Do the check. Okay. So if you think B is the more accurate picture of how development progresses, then click on the check in right above, the green check right above your chat room indicator, your chat room box. And can people click the X as well for C? So I'm looking at, yes, and so if you think that C is the best one, the best portrayal, then click on the red X. So great, I see people are voting, and it looks like we have a pretty diverse vote. We have a lot of people choosing B, many more B than A, and a few people also selecting C. Well, it turns out, if you haven't yet voted, you're going to, you know, have a chance to hear the answer before you enter. If you haven't yet voted, the correct answer, the best portrayal of development, is actually C. So if you hit the red X, you hit the jackpot. A, obviously, was obviously not the best picture of development because very few children in general just move upward and upward in a very clear, neat, even way. In B, we do have captured the more staccato, advance a little bit, and then plateau, advance and plateau. But C is the only option that captures a developmental reality that's really critical for teachers to understand. Could we have the next slide, please? Not only is development an irregular progression that's unique to each child, but very typically, children will backslide in preparation for moving forward. We see this all the time in very young children. I know we have some people on our call who teach, I heard 4-year-olds who teach elementary, young kindergartners. But we see in toddlers that they'll become very cranky or perhaps lose a skill. They're not holding their cup well on Monday, and on Tuesday they start walking. We don't realize, but this happens with school-age children as well. So that a child who's about to master decoding and become a fluent reader may be more klutzy the week before and actually have some developmental slippage in another area. It's almost as if our body is rallying all of its energy for forward movement in one area, and so we get a little sloppy in other areas. The last thought I want us to keep in mind about developmental realities is you've probably heard the term, any of you who have children at pediatric visits, at well baby visits, you've heard the term of milestones. When did they reach their developmental milestones? At what age did they walk and did they talk? And when did they first sit up? And when did the first words come out? Milestones are really only guideposts. They really should be, rather than firm dates or times, very broad ranges, because is a wide range at which achieving that milestone is still typical. There are babies who walk at, even as early as 9 months. And then there are children who are quite typical and normal in their development who don't get up on two legs until well into their first year. And all of that is typical. And anyone who teaches first grade knows that the reading curve and the learning curve for reading is also very broad in first grade. In general, the guideposts for developmental milestones and the range of what is still in the typical field is wider the younger you are. And the older we get, the more narrow is the band
for what's typical. If we could go to the next slide, please. As we begin talking more about other students, whether things are typical or not, it's also important for us to think about what's the end product? What does a healthy, well-developed child look like and act like? And healthy, well-developed children will, in an age-appropriate manner, show us three areas of success. One area is they will have good feelings about themselves and about others. So they'll have self-confidence, they'll be trusting of others, they'll be able to relate and show empathy. They'll also have well-developed skills and capacities in the area called self-regulation. Okay. So that means they'll be able to handle and channel their frustration and anger. They'll be able to hold their impulses or contain inappropriate emotions. They'll be able to wait and delay desire. And finally, they'll show success in areas of mastery and resilience. Mastery that will include academic cognitive tasks, physical and social tasks, and resilience that will include being able to cope with adversity. And if we could move on.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure, please do.
The second thing of able to constructively channel frustration and anger and impulses and everything, self-regulation, if somebody is unable to do that as an adult, does that mean that they never learned how to do it as a child, that they sort of became fixated at that stage or never learned at that point?
That's a great question. Now, we're going to talk about temperament in a moment, so that keep in mind, can we go back to that slide for a moment? So keep in mind that that area of self-regulation is enormously variable, both in children and in adults. So when you say to me, if an adult is unable to tolerate frustration, in the same way that I would want to know a lot about David, I would want to know, do you mean it's an adult who, when they, as I did this morning, go out to their car and find 3 inches of snow instead of the dusting they said, and need an extra 20 minutes to clean off their car, are muttering under their breath, and kick a little bit of snow around, that's one end of a continuum or you know, moving towards an end of a continuum versus an adult who, you know, God forbid, becomes abusive and erratic and is violent. So you can have minor difficulties with self-regulation or major difficulties with self-regulation, and you can actually have skills that you developed as a child that erode as you age. You can also have skills that you never developed in childhood that thankfully we get to master in our adult life. I'm the perfect example. I didn't learn my multiplication tables until I was an adult. Somehow I just got away with it in school. It wasn't until I was an adult and became an avid card player that I learned my math facts. It's complicated, and all of these difficulties, by the way, or all of these areas, I wish that every adult that we met had perfectly well-developed confidence and relatedness, self-regulation, motivation, mastery, and resilience. We'd all be perfect, but it's a much more interesting world. We all struggle with these areas in different ways. Now we could go to the next slide. Some important considerations to determine whether something is normal or atypical or not is the notion of individual differences, that all of us are different. And one of the ways that we need to consider those differences is to think in terms of tasks, transitions, and ecological risks. And I'll talk about what I mean by those in a moment. But in general, both normal and atypical development are really best understood when we look at the individual in the most complex way, assessing all of these risk factors and all of the multiple developmental domains. In other words, not just looking at does this child know their math facts and what's going on at home, but looking at the complex mix of all of these things together. And if we could have the next slide. So if we put these pieces together, how do we look at these three areas of development or goals, self-confidence, self-regulation, and mastery, in terms of the means towards development or the challenges that children face, which are their tasks, their transitions, and their ecological risks. The next slide. We come up with this very complicated looking picture of development in the elementary years. Across the top are our three goals. We want confident, related, self-regulated, motivated, mastering, resilient students. But through the elementary school years, and I would include the preschool years as well, children have a series of tasks, transitions, and risks that are fairly, I've included some of the ones that are fairly common here, that both promote development and help them move forward, but also can serve as a challenge. So, for example, one of the first tasks that happens, whether children begin school at 2 or at 4, is that they have to move into the arena of cooperative play. And that task helps children learn relatedness. But all of us can probably think of students where cooperative play has also been an arena of struggle and challenge. Similarly, another task that happens in elementary school that helps children develop self-regulation is that they have to learn to follow externally determined rules. They have to follow a schedule. They don't get to go to the gym whenever they want. They only go when the third grade has gym. And certainly in the area of motivation and mastery and resilience, elementary school children are challenged to master, just in the secular world, reading, writing, and arithmetic. And certainly you could add all of the Lamude Kodesh tasks, like Kriya skills in fourth grade or third grade whenever your school introduces it, Rashi or Mishnah whenever those are brought in. And similarly, there are transitions in the elementary years that both build and challenge. I've given you some examples. And there are risks. And I've divided risks into what I would call internal issues, which we'll get to in a moment. That's temperament. And what I've called genuine challenges, external issues. So people alluded before when we talked about David to whether or not David has family issues that are going on. Are there any tasks, transitions, or risks that anyone wants to add that you think are particularly salient or relevant in both promoting or challenging the development through the elementary years?
Development, is this
I'm having trouble hearing you. Can you speak louder?
Well.
Okay, I'm going to go on to the next slide. Feel free to do
something that I thought of, Dr. Novick.
Yes, please.
Yeah, just maybe it has to do with listening to others, you know, to rules. But just self-regulation, just being able to hold back and be able to control your impulses.
Yes, absolutely. And if you think about, as you know, as we go from preschool up through sixth grade, think about how much more is required of you with each year, so that we require less of a preschooler in their ability to hold back their impulses, although we do require some, but we require a lot from a sixth grader.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. This is Shana. The structure of the kind of path going from preschool to kindergarten through first into third grade become less sensory motor, less experiential with their body, and more on a cognitive, perceptual, fine motor continuum. So the ability to really use their bodies gets diminished, and that's not always with the development of the child ready to transition.
That's a great example, Shana. Thank you. It's so clear that a child for whom movement is useful to their learning is going to have a much harder time or be challenged to find other ways to learn and to not have that gross motor outlet. Certainly, you're absolutely right, as the years progress. If we could have the next slide, all behavior develops on a continuum. As I said before, there isn't a point at which we say, oh, hitting is not normal. It's not typical at this age. There's a continuum, and I've given you a sample, a very kind of rough developmental continuum of aggressive behavior. So that aggression occurs at all ages, from whether you're an infant or whether you're a high school student, but the topology of the behavior changes in significant ways. So that if I tell you that a child has bitten another student, and I don't tell you the age, it's very hard for you to know whether that's typical or atypical behavior. Because again, in infants and toddlers bite. They don't do it every day, but they do it when they get frustrated. And it is not uncommon for me to get a referral, well, I would say several times a year, from a nursery school calling about a student who is biting. It is very rare, I don't think in over 20 years of practice, I have gotten a referral from a third grader who's biting. It's a very rare behavior in third grade. And if we want to say that by definition, atypical is something that happens very, very rarely, then we can say that biting in third grade is not typical behavior. So if you look at the progression, it very much as we were looking at in our earlier chart, behavior becomes more controlled. So it's not that aggression disappears, it's that physical aggression gets replaced by verbal and social aggression, that it moves more into the arena of fighting with siblings and peers, that outlets like sports and sarcasm in the verbal arena develop, and that one thing that I added in the high school age, because it's so clear there, but it's true in all of them, is the role of culture. So that one of the external factors we have to think about when we think about what is typical, we have to think about the culture that this child lives in. Are they in a family where all arguments are solved with your hands? Are they part of a culture that believes, endorses, and supports physical aggression? Even if they are not, you may still see aggression in situations that are themselves disinhibiting. For example, in the high school years, we'll see children doing things on the internet that they would never do in person. If I could have the next slide. If we would think about this idea of a developmental continuum for a different phenomena, for the phenomena of distractibility, would anyone like to suggest, perhaps for the grade level that you teach in, what you think might be typical for a student in terms of their distractibility at your grade level? What can we expect from a kindergartner or from a fifth grader?
This is Robin, and I teach fifth grade general studies.
Mm-hmm.
And distractibility in my class, a lot of doodling, playing with some kind of toy or scissors or something, is easily distracts them, looking around mm-hmm. the room.
Mm-hmm. So those are all things that again, if it's so critical to hear that, Robin, and it's so helpful, because your experience helps you to understand that if someone wanted to refer a fifth grader for doodling, saying, oh, this is a sign there's something wrong with this child, you could say, wait a minute, in fifth grade, doodling is very common. It's something we see all the time. Any other examples? And thanks for putting the doodling in, Betsy. Just an example of what isn't typical, I was asked to observe a third grade girl's Chumash lesson because the teacher said that this girl's distractibility was off the charts. It was just impossible to keep them focused on Chumash. And she didn't understand because she did not have the problem with Lashon. The English teacher said it wasn't a problem. 90 minutes into the observation, when the teacher was still teaching third grade girls the same Chumash lesson, I understood why she could not get them to focus, because I don't know that I as an adult have a 90-minute ability to sit in one place and focus on one task. someone else wanted to add something?
Well, I think Dr. Feuerman used to teach us that, you know, lessons can't really even go on longer than 20 minutes, 15, 20 minutes, you know,
mm-hmm.
at a time of learning something new. I mean, I think kids are made to sit for a lot longer than that to listen to a lesson, but
absolutely.
20 minutes, I mean, that's not so long, but that's what he
right.
used to say.
Right. So that it's also an example of how a developmental factor or phenomena like distractibility, of course, interacts with the environment, that is, the lesson plan, the classroom. Am I going to be more distractible if I'm a fifth grader in a classroom where they happen to be doing construction out the window and there's this really cool crane that's tearing down the building across the street? Well, you know, you can't use the normal paradigm of development on a day like that. If we could go to the next slide.
Oh, this is Robin again. I was going to say some
yes.
kind of untypical, not typical distractibility would be impulsive calling out, something that has nothing to do with the lesson that's going on, or a child who's fidgeting or constantly getting out of their seat to go to their backpack or their cubby. That's a distractibility that's not has nothing to do with the lesson or the normalcy or commonality in the grade.
Right. Again, I think it's a matter of degree and a matter of age. So if you told me that three times during the day Aviva does that and she's a nursery school student or a kindergartner, I'm going to be much less concerned than if you say every 3 minutes this child is in their backpack or their cubby or someplace else, and much less concerned than I would be if it is a fourth or fifth grade student who seems unable to, even with a 20-minute or a 15-minute lesson, to be able to be at their workspace and able to complete or focus on a task for a reasonable amount of time. So that's a really good point. There are protective factors in development, external support systems like families and schools, affectional ties, that is, having people who care about you and who you care about, and finally, the area that I want to spend some time focusing on, our disposition or our temperament. And if I could have the next slide. Temperament is thought of as a protective factor, but it also can cause challenges. Let me see a show of hands. How many of you have more than one child of your own? Use your hand raising. Oh, your hands are popping up. The vast majority of us have more than one child. Okay. So you know probably, you probably knew within days of your second or third that babies are born different, that each one has their own unique combination not only of physical characteristics but of their patterns of behavior. And on this slide, I've included the 9 typical factors in temperament that are usually studied or discussed. So they include activity. Some of you may have brought home from the nursery a very calm, not very moving, sedate baby. And others, a baby who was always tangled in their blankets, was always all over the place. That's activity level. Regularity. L2 can routinely sleep and eat on a schedule. Is predictable. Is easy to fit into a schedule versus a child who seems to have no sleep cycle, no eating pattern. And of course, temperament was first studied with babies, but we'll talk about what this might look like in a classroom. Then there's the issue of initial reaction. How does a person react to something new or novel or surprising? And what's your first reaction? Is your first reaction, oh, that's cool? Or is your first reaction, that's scary? Distractibility is a temperamental factor that we just talked about. Adaptability refers to how well an individual can adapt to change and how long we go from that initial reaction to actually becoming comfortable with something or adapting to it. Intensity refers to whether when I'm upset as an infant, I whimper, or whether I scream at the top of my lungs. And mood refers to whether an infant is basically happy or is basically cranky. Persistence refers to their ability to deal with frustration and keep going and keep at something. And sensitivity often includes things like tactual sensitivity, but also beyond that, how reactive, how easy does the child notice changes in light, temperature, sound, people around them, etc. The next slide. Now, why does this matter as we're talking about students in our classroom? So let's look at Shira and Sarah. Imagine Shira, the easy baby, regular schedule for eating and sleeping. Oh, she's a parent's dream. She took to everyone quickly, loved new things, persisted with difficult tasks. She was usually calm, and if upset, you could soothe her very easily, and she just seemed happy most of the time. We're all drooling, right? This is just such a wonderful bracha to have in your house. And then there's Sarah, colicky and never slept, finicky about who could come near her. When Aunt Sadie visits, she screams. She doesn't want to go to Grandma. She fears all things new. She's tentative in most situations. And if she'll try something new, she quickly rejects it. She's often very fussy and hard to soothe. And when she gets upset, boy, her reactions are intense. What do you think each of these girls looked like in their first grade class? If you were teaching Shira or Sarah, what would you say?
Well, Shira's probably sitting there nicely and listening to her lesson, and she's just doing whatever the teacher tells her to do, and she's behaving, and Sarah is probably a problem to deal with, I would just say off the top of my head.
I actually have a child who was Shira as a baby and is now Sarah as a third grader.
I have one of those also.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it does happen. It does happen that sometimes they start out with, in their very early baby years, with a very kind of overdeveloped rhythmicity and regularity, and then they become a little bit looser as they go on. Any other comments about what they might look like in your classroom?
Sarah might be more cautious when she approaches learning.
Mm-hmm.
And Shira might approach learning with more enthusiasm.
Yes. There's actually a wonderful, I tried to incorporate it, but it's a very old video that I have of Jerome Kagan's experiments where he followed infants. He's followed them now to their adulthood, but this is a very old video clip. It's so old that it's on video, not, you know, DVD. It's on old VHS, which is why you can't easily put it into here. But in this video, he has two babies. I'll call them Shira and Sarah. And in the first experiment, when he first meets them, they're about 6 months old and they're in infant seats. And when he shows Shira a mobile, an infant mobile, and has a video, an audio-taped voice that sounds very strange that says, "You are a very good baby," Shira looks around with interest but remains calm. Sarah gets so upset that she almost catapults herself out of her infant seat and cries and can't be soothed. Fast forward, and they're 2 years old, and the same two girls come into the next day of the experiment. And in the two-year-old experiment, they come into a playroom that's filled with toys and things to climb on with their mom. Shira quickly separates from her mom and is bouncing and climbing and jumping and showing mom toys and is just so happy in this place. And Sarah is crying hysterically and won't let go of her mother's skirts. The last part of the video shows Shira and Sarah at first grade age. In a simulation of a classroom with one experimenter who gives Shira the following instruction. Scribble in the brand new book. And Shira says, "Why?" She asks the experimenter a question, and she doesn't do it. When Sarah is given an instruction to, in her case, it wasn't scribble on the book, it was spill water on the sofa. She looks kind of puzzled, but she won't ask, and she just does it. So the interesting thing is that we had some of you gave both, you know, we gave both answers, that some of you thought Shira would be more gutsy, others thought Shira would be more kind of compliant and an easy student. The reality is that temperament can affect children in all different ways. Can we have the next slide, please? And that what's normal for each person relates to some extent to what feels normal, what works in the temperament. If you think about, for example, in terms of activity, I'm one of those people whose activity level is set fairly high, so you don't want to go to the beach with me for a relaxing vacation, because I don't do sit still at the beach well. I am looking for shells, and then let's take out a boat, and then let's do something else, because that's just what's normal for me, for my temperament. But extremes of temperament may seem outside the norm or atypical to others. So my best friend, who loves nothing better than to sit still and read a book, thinks that I'm a lunatic, and we vacation together all the time, thinks that I'm a lunatic. Why would I not just enjoy sitting still and doing nothing? Now, even though temperament is our pre-wired from the factory instructions that we come with, it is malleable. It is changeable, but not without significant effort. So I can sit still, and I often do, but it isn't my basic nature to do that. And if you think about the students who've been challenging in your classrooms, either now or over the years, of the temperamental factors that we had a while back, of those 9 temperamental factors, which are those that you think were mostly an issue? Is it activity? Is it regularity? Distractibility? Adaptability? Intensity? Anybody have a particular temperamental factor that's been challenging in their classroom?
Well, distractibility.
All of the above, depending upon the child.
All of the above. Yes. I think that, like in many of the areas that we address in Hidden Sparks, that sometimes the issue is also the fit between the teacher and the student. You know, Spiffy just wrote in defiance. So that might be a temperamental factor of intensity. So again, a child who's defiant, who says very calmly and very politely, Rebbe or Mora, I'd really rather not do that right now, might be much less challenging than a child who rips it up, throws it in your face, and says, I'm not doing your stupid project. So it's not just the behavior, but it's the behavior through the lens of temperament. And if I am a teacher who my own temperamental style is to be highly regular, highly planful and scheduled, and you, little darling, are now telling me you will not go to gym right now, that is going to be a more difficult story than if I'm a teacher who is extraordinarily adaptable. And so if you say to me, I'm not doing this now, it doesn't bother me. Temperamentally, I go with the flow. So it's not just temperamental factors that make our students challenging, but it's sometimes how they mesh with our own temperament. Could we have the next slide, please?
Can I ask a question?
Please do.
But how would that play out in the classroom? In other words, like, you have your lesson or the material that has to get done. You know, so how flexible can you be in terms of, okay, we're not doing that. You know, we'll do what you want to do.
Well, I don't know that you can be flexible in saying, we are not doing that, but if a particular student says, I don't want to do this math right now, that you may have a classroom. It depends on what else is going on, but it is possible that you might say, I certainly do hear teachers say, well, that's a choice, and we'll have to figure out, we'll have to talk in a minute, when I have a minute, we'll have to talk about when you will do the math. Or, oh, well, if you're not doing the math now, maybe you will do the science first and then do the math. you know, if they're in centers or they're working in you know, at their own pace, and somebody says, I'm not reading this story, I'm reading the next one, it doesn't matter. It really depends on what the setup is in the classroom. Unfortunately, many classrooms are organized as if the entire group will move in lockstep at the same time, at the same pace, in the same way. And we know that for diverse learners, for students with diverse temperament, that is, I wouldn't say a recipe for disaster, but it's certainly a challenging paradigm. Because not everyone is going to finish at the same time or want to do math first thing in the morning. So that the minute you create rigidity, there's a chance that it's not going to work for someone. And the more you can be flexible and think about particularly involving students in understanding their temperament. Imagine, by the way, a classroom where we talk about metacognition. I'd love us to be meta-temperament. Imagine when, you know, if, not David, let's say Daniel says defiantly, well, I don't want to do my math right now. Imagine if we'd already talked in our classroom about temperament and about the fact that some of us have a harder time with schedules or changes than others. And so when that happens, it's good for us to go to the cool-down corner, or it's good for us to do something else first and then come back to it. Or we need, as Shana was talking about before, we need to do something physical with our bodies when that happens. So maybe we should go to the exercise mat and do a few sit-ups and then come back and do our work.
Unfortunately,
we don't usually talk to children about their temperament, and so they don't know what this is. Someone wanted to add something?
Yes. My question is, I've always found that these things work in the younger grades, where you can give as many choices as possible, and it really is possible. But as kids get older, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, where the flexibility of teachers, and I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's certainly much more difficult, when you're giving these children all these choices, okay, do the science first, do this first, do that first, what happens as they get older when it just doesn't happen? Not in high school, not in college, and not in real life.
Well, the truth is it actually does happen in real life. In real life as adults, we are constantly much more masterful about how we schedule things, what we do first. We plan, well, I'm going to go to the dry cleaners before I go to the grocery store so the groceries won't spoil, or that feels better for me, or I don't like making that left turn into traffic, so I'm going to go the long way around. We make our accommodations as adults all the time. Children aren't able to do that in their school environment. But what I'd like to say about your question is, I think that the more we engage students in the process of really collaborative problem solving, the better all of this is. So that, for example, exactly the question you're raising, was that Rabbi Sabol? Yeah. Exactly the question that you're raising, that imagine a student who learns in their elementary years about themselves that this is something I struggle with, that I have a hard time when I have to fit into somebody else's schedule, when somebody draws a line in the sand and says, I have to do this lesson right now, and I've learned that about myself, and therefore I know how to handle it. In some cases, I can handle it by doing something different. In other cases, I have to just bite my lip, do it for a few minutes until the 40-minute period is over. In other words, if we give children the tools and the skills to understand, that's what's happening. I'm having a hard time because X, Y, or Z, then it's a little bit easier for them. And they can carry those tools and those skills with them into, shall we say, less friendly environments or less flexible environments. Although, again, you talk about, well, in high school it doesn't happen. I teach at a university where students come and go at will, where it's very common, and I teach graduate classes, people get up in the middle of a class. If they need to walk out, they walk out. It's very different than being a fifth grader where you can't walk out of a room without your teacher's permission. So we do cycle through things. I want to be sure, before we run out of time, that we have a moment just to come back to David. And all of your questions are terrific questions. Because David unfolds with even more behaviors that might ask us to think, is this typical? As the teacher asks the class to join her in the science area, and he seems ecstatic that science is happening, so he begins giggling and flapping his arms, standing next to his seat. When the teacher begins the lesson, David interrupts virtually every sentence with facts about the solar system and the universe. There's just one problem. The lesson happens to be on life forms in swampy areas. So again, what are the things you would want to know in order to answer, is this typical, and are you becoming concerned about David and why?
Yeah, I'm concerned about David because he can't seem to be on task. You know, he seems to be able to identify with the subject, but not with the subject matter. So, you know, he's not with everyone else there.
Right.
I'm certainly concerned about him. The flapping his arms and giggling, that's all. You know, we still don't know how old he is, but is that typical behavior for his age?
Right.
Or
with very young children, at least in my experience in first grade, kindergarten, first grade, certainly, and into second, the kids are so self-centered that almost anything you offer to them calls for, well, my cousin used to do this. And so on. So if he's at that age and everything he's talking about happens to be what he's interested in, that would certainly not be atypical. It may become pernicious if it gets so pronounced, but if you look at other kids in the classroom, they're showing some of the same behaviors also, maybe in a more restrained way.
Now, you have to know to what degree he's doing this also, because some kids will do that to some small degree, you know, bring in unrelated things or somewhat related things. But if they're doing it to such a degree that they're totally off task and they're not even at all addressing the topic that's being addressed, then there seems to be something really wrong there.
Absolutely. So we keep on coming back to the question of age, what grade is this? What's the kind of norm? What else is going on in the classroom? Are other students doing this? And frequency. A lot of us will have, a very rare slip where we do something out of character, you know, once in 5 years, that is not necessarily cause for alarm. But when something is happening on a very regular basis, you know, if this is the only time the teacher has ever seen this, then she may have to say, let me keep my eye on this. I wonder if this is, you know, something I should be concerned about. If on the other hand she's saying, oh, here we go again, David and that solar system, that's all he ever does, no matter what we talk about in science, and he talks about it in English and in math and in social studies also, we'll have to look at whether this is an issue. Could we have the next slide, please? I want to skip this one and go to the next one. Those were just some other examples of students. Because I want to talk about, if we were to think of areas that would raise the proverbial red flag or warrant concern, what should you look for? What should you be concerned about? Certainly in the academic area, we're going to look at how does a student's skill level match with others on their grade, realizing that not everybody in every grade is going to be at the same level. There's a range. But is their academic level within what is usual for this age? I want to look not only at level, but what's the learning curve like? When I work with this student, when I'm introducing a behavior, somebody started this evening by saying in their own life they had focused on whether they took longer to pick things up sometimes. That's an issue of not skill level, but of learning progression or learning curve. And another area that might warrant concern in academics is a pattern of skills, where a child might have incredible gifts in one area and incredible weaknesses in another. By the way, when I say that they warrant concern, I do not mean that they warrant diagnosis, that they warrant treatment. I simply mean that these raise questions in my mind that say, let me see if I need more information or if I need to keep an eye on this, or if I need to have a qualified person look further at what's happening with this child. In the social area, things that are a particular concern are withdrawal. And by withdrawal, I mean of greatest concern is a child who was interacting and now has pulled back. That is of more concern than the kind of shyness that someone shared with us also this evening, starting out shy, always being shy, and being more withdrawn in that way. Odd social behavior can be cause for concern, and clinginess and issues with separation become a concern when they are out of developmental sync. So, again, I am not the least bit concerned about a three-year-old who's having trouble with the start of school. But I do think of it as atypical when I hear that a fifth grader won't go to school independently, wants mom in the class with them, etc. In the affective or emotional area, obviously severe and persistent depression. All children get sad from time to time. But when it's depression that is unmoving or unshifting, or rapidly shifting moods, a child who is elated and happy and then horribly depressed, of high levels of anxiety, and with anxiety, avoidance. So being very, very worried about something, so worried that the child won't engage. And again, I would never, a child who says, oh, I'm not playing with a tarantula, is not in this category. I'm talking about high levels of anxiety or avoidance for things that most children of their age would readily engage with. And in terms of behavior, we've talked about aggression, perseveration, being stuck on something, doing something over and over again, or having rituals can be a sign of difficulty, and persistent tantrums. Again, in a terrible toddler too, we're not very concerned about it, but in an older child, we can be concerned. The last slide, please. So if we were to wrap up our discussion tonight, we know that no one factor determines whether something is normal or typical, that we have to understand really not only the whole child, but the whole situation. And, you know, people have in the chat room put diagnoses or labels like Asperger's, he's self-absorbed. Whenever possible, we're rarely in education called on to diagnose, and so it's important that we be descriptive rather than evaluative. Our evaluation may be to say, we're concerned because this child's behavior is so unusual for our classroom. And when red flags emerge, certainly explore, intervene in an educational way, and if seriously concerned, then consider referral to an appropriate professional. Of course, engaging the parents and possibly with older children, even speaking with the child about their behavior. So I think that we're pretty much at the end of our time, and that I hope that we certainly have come to a point to think about development and that question of, is this typical, as a really complex one. Any closing comments or questions?
Dr. Novick? Yeah.
Yes.
How do I print out these slides? They're great.
That's a Betsy question.
Okay.
you can go to the web within the next 24 hours. You can go to the Hidden Sparks website and go to the archives for Hidden Sparks Without Walls, and you'll be able to download the PowerPoint and print them out.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. Rona, thank you so much for such an informative session. What I'm going to do now is thank people for their participation. People are welcome to stay on the phone line and continue the conversation a little bit. I just need to take care of some housekeeping, and then people are free to stay on after our 9 o'clock session. Just to highlight upcoming Hidden Sparks Without Walls sessions, next week Dr. Novick will be continuing with her second session, which will be, Is This Typical? Understanding Variations in Child Development, talking about secondary school students. And then a couple of weeks later, we will have a session with Dr. Judah Weller core classroom practices in Judaic and general studies that reflect an appreciation of all kinds of learners in the classroom. People can register for these upcoming sessions at the Hidden Sparks website. Tonight's session will be available in about 24 hours. As I said before, you will be able to hear the audio. You'll be able to download the PowerPoint so that you can use it with other people and for your own reference. And again, please, within the next few minutes, you'll be receiving a survey to your email. Please, if you could fill it out, it really helps us for future planning if you complete it and return it to us at Hidden Sparks. And Rona and Betsy, thank you so much for such an interesting and smooth webinar tonight. And again, people are welcome to continue on in the conversation over the phone line now. Thank you so much.
Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us. Any last comments or questions?
Can I ask you how old David was?
Oh, that's a good question.
Oh, it's a great question. So now I can, you know, reveal the actual David. David was in first grade. He is a young man who the school was quite concerned about him transitioning to first grade given the struggles that they experienced with him in kindergarten. The many of the things that I described for you were actually very pervasive and frequent behaviors. So that his, you know, taking himself to the corner and talking to himself was happening multiple times a day. His diverting the topic from the conversation was happening, oh my gosh, every single time there was circle time or any group lesson. I'm telling you, I think his first grade class knew more about the universe than most NASA astronauts because he would take the conversation to that direction all the time. And his flapping, his hand flapping and jumping and bouncing and at times he would giggle to himself all happened all the time. Now, the interesting thing is I have to give you the postscript. So the school was convinced that his behavior was atypical. They were very concerned and sent him for an evaluation, which, as these things often do, took an inordinate amount of time to complete. And in the interim, they added another aide to the classroom who was just a wonderful woman who worked extensively with David, saying things to him when he would get very excited and start flapping, like, David, look around. What are your classmates doing now? Is anybody else doing what you're doing? And, you know, David would then kind of regroup and organize himself. And if you started talking about, you know, the universe, she would say, she sat right next to him all the time, said, David, is anybody else talking about the universe now? And she did this. And by the time the evaluation was finished, I was doing some observations unrelated to him in the classroom, but they said, while you're there, could you keep an eye and take a look at him? He actually looked more typical than three other students in the classroom. So, you know, these are areas where you have to be, especially with, I find, the younger children, be very cautious about assigning a label or prognosis or assuming that something is atypical. Sometimes children are atypical because we've not yet given them the skills to look typical. And if we can give them the skills and the tools, then they can we can promote their development.
But sometimes we have to find a definition for the child, not so much labeling them, but finding out, like I said, self-absorbed, because knowing he's self-absorbed in certain ways, having an aide in the classroom to get him out and see what's going on around him. So I don't think we were actually labeling, but we were trying to find a definitive way to describe him so we could find out how to help. You know?
Absolutely. And I think that's the descriptiveness that is so critical, that it's much, it just occurred to me that descriptives help you lead to prescriptives.
You know, it's much easier to prescribe what a child needs if you have a rich description of what it is they're struggling with, whereas a word or a label doesn't tell me enough about how to be helpful.
That's good. It's good to remember. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Have a wonderful evening, everybody.
Thank you, Dr. Novick. This is great.
Good.
Penny. Hi.
Hi, Penny.
Hi. I passed my comps.